Hi, I'm Mike Beal.
And I'm Leah Beal.
I know your voice is naturally low, but is there something that's been going on in Brooklyn these past 4 years I should know about?
Oh, no, I'm putting my voice through a pitch shifter. It's one of the four types of sound manipulation that we're going to be talking about today.
That's right. We're also going to be discussing envelope reshaping and editing. But first, we'll be discussing the... Whoa! Okay. Yes. But first, we'll be discussing the relationship between pitch and tempo.
Whenever anyone speaks or performs...
Wireless.
Whenever anyone speaks or performs live in nature, like we're doing now, how fast or how slowly we talk or play is independent of the pitch of the sound. Pitch, of course, is related to the number of vibrations per second. The pitch goes up when the number of vibrations or frequency goes up, and pitch goes down when frequency goes down. We can change that independently of how fast or how slow the notes or words come.
But once the waveform of the sound is recorded mechanically or electrically, under most circumstances, these two aspects of sound are fused together forever. If you increase the speed of the playback of the recording, you increase the tempo because the beats come faster. Likewise, if you increase the pitch, because the vibrations are also coming faster.
Or vice versa if it's lower.
Edison might have already known this even before his first tinfoil phonograph, because that invention grew out of experiments to play recordings of telegraph messages faster.
And he had also been playing around with a tape strip recorder that was pulled through by hand.
He may also have been considering using speeded up recordings as a means of faster replay of telephone messages. So he must have known of the relationship between pitch and tempo the first time he tried to play back a tinfoil on his hand crank machine.
But it is significant that although he had fooled around with overdubbing second voices on top of the first voice almost immediately, whenever the phonograph was demonstrated, every effort was made to make sure that the playback of the recording was performed at the original speed. There were always accusations that trickery was involved, using ventriloquists or mimics hidden under the table or behind a curtain. So even though the phonograph was described as sounding like a parrot with a sore throat, they always tried to make sure the voices sounded as close to the original as possible.
The living voice of the artist, clear, flawless, and natural.
That's the other side of this sample Columbia Double Beal record.
When Leah decided to do this project last year, I started asking around if anybody had come across a record from the acoustical era which played around with the speed of the recording to create trick effects. After all, silent movies often undercranked action scenes to make things like the Kingstone Cops chase scenes faster and more frenetic. But everyone seemed to want to make commercial sound recordings sound as natural as possible, despite the seeming disparity of secretly advising users to play back their records slightly faster than they were recorded. Victor advising 78 when most are recorded at 76, Columbia saying 80 instead of 78. But this was not for humorous trick effects. If they wanted funny voices or laughing trombones, they actually performed them this way. The only exception anyone's been able to come up with was an article in the November 25th, 1905 Scientific American that Patrick Feaster found, an article by Dexter W. Ellis, that suggested using your home cylinder recording machine to make a trick recording of Tom Thumb. They suggested that you first make a regular announcement at regular speed, like, "A visit with Tom Thumb, Edison Records."
And then stop the machine, reduce the recording speed, and then carefully say something like,
"I am so very happy to be with you today."
Which would come back at a much higher pitch when played back at normal speed. We asked Patrick if he'd ever come across a home-recorded cylinder that had done something like this, and he said no.
But a very important principle was revealed to us in this description, a principle that has proven true in almost every novelty recording made in the 100 years since then, that if you have a speed-adjusted voice or instrument, it must always be coupled with voices or instruments at normal speed. Think about this. Exceptions to this rule are very rare, because if you want all the sounds to vary in pitch, you could do it yourself by screwing around with the playback speed of your machine.
As we entered the electrical recording era and sound films, we still found no examples through the first decade. If they wanted funny voices and sounds in cartoons, they generally created them naturally. Ventriloquists also created their funny character voices naturally. We have heard reports of a few isolated voices in cartoons by the mid to late 30s that might have been speed manipulated. And into the 1940s, there are examples that even include the master of voices, Mel Blanc. But these are hard to track and prove. Sometimes they're just making an already funny voice a little funnier. It's a subject worthy of a separate investigation by the film people. But the first major use of speed manipulation comes in a very prominent feature motion picture, 1939's The Wizard of Oz.
It turns out that in the Munchkin scene, there were four types of voices used and mixed together. Sound designer Douglas Shearer used the normal voices of a female chorus, children's voices, the voices of the little people, and speeded up voices of adult males with deep, natural voices. As strange as it seems, instead of slightly speeding up already high-pitched voices, they went to several very deep voice announcers, reportedly Pinto Colvig and Billy Bletcher, and greatly speeded up their voices.
We know this now because of some of the recording sessions have been released in the special edition, the special feature section of the film's DVD. Here are a few examples from the half hour or so that they provide. Notice in the slates the announcement of the film recording speed of 55 feet per minute. The normal speed for 35 millimeter film is 90 feet per minute.
We'll first hear the session and slates at 90 feet, then, as originally recorded, at 55 feet.
Oh, we caught you too.
As mayor of the Munchkin City, in the county of the Land of Oz, I welcome you most regally, but we've got to verify it legally to see if she is morally, ethically,
spiritually, physically,
positively, absolutely, undeniably, and reliably dead. As coroner, I must have her. I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead.
2086, take one. Recorded to orchestra playback track 2414, film AAR and RWAX, turning 55 feet per minute.
Fellas, you're getting someplace. We go right into a take on that.
Oh, we thought you took it.
Oh, it was rehearsal. We wanted to see how it would work out.
A little slower. Both slower.
2086, take one.
Mayor of the Munchkin City, in the county of the Land of Oz, I welcome you most regally,
but we've got to verify it legally to see if she is morally, ethically,
spiritually, physically,
positively, absolutely, undeniably, and reliably dead.
As coroner, I must have her. I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead.
2086, take one.
recorded to orchestra playback track 2414, film AAR and RWAX, turning 55 feet per minute.
As suspected, there appears to also have been manipulation to the already deep voices of the Witch's Guard. But only one short recording is included in the DVD, originally recorded at 110 feet per minute, to be reduced to 90 feet. But you'll have to take our word for this, because the DVD player finked out on us when we went to dub it. Now, this did not open the floodgates of speed manipulation recordings. After all, the tricks used in The Wizard of Oz were not well publicized, and the studio recorded album that Decca released did not use any of these tricks. For the next half decade, the only example I've been able to come across on record is one part of one side recorded by a man who already had a myriad of funny voices, Danny Kaye. He had already used three or four funny voices on his January 1942 recording of Gershwin's The Babbitt and the Bromide, when somehow someone dreamed up a way to make heaven even funnier than on earth.
Before they met again some 20 years they had to wait. This time it happened up above inside St. Peter's Gate. A half one was carrying and both were wearing wings, and this is what they said as they were strumming on the strings.
Hello.
How are you?
How's it goes?
What's new?
I'm great.
That's good.
Ha ha.
How cool.
Well, well.
What's the say?
How you been?
Nice thing.
How's Rick's?
What's new?
That's fine.
How are you?
You've grown a little stouter since I saw you last, I think. You must come over someday and we'll have a little drink. I hope.
That's right.
What's new?
How's the bike?
Got to run.
Oh, my.
That's all.
Oh, no,
goodbye.
When the war ended and the baby boom commenced, it ushered in an era that many of us baby boomers like to call the golden age of children's records. A few, but not many, of these records utilize sound manipulation tricks. One prime example is Alan Livingston's Sparky's Magic Piano. In this section, he utilizes double speeding, but not too intelligently, because he didn't have the piano recorded one octave lower so that the only effect would be that of to seemingly speed up Sparky's fingers.
If you play it in a minute, I'll play it close to half a minute.
Oh, Sparky, that's funny. No one in the world can play the Flight of the Bumblebee anywhere near half a minute.
Piano, can you play it that fast?
Yes, Sparky.
I will do it. Listen.
Why, I can't believe it, Zee. Didn't I tell you? Just fly over the keys. They hardly seem to touch them to go so fast.
But did you notice something else?
Yes, the piano talked. How'd they do that?
This brings us back to the second of our sound manipulation techniques, envelope shaping. It's rather complicated, but the way a sound begins and ends and how it is shaped in between is how we understand spoken language. Usually, our mouth and lips and tongue do the shaping of the sound that originates from our vocal folds. If we could instead insert the sound of the musical instrument or device we would want to speak into our throat, we could make it talk.
What is now done with an electronic device called the vocoder was done mechanically back then using a patented device called Sonovox. Invented by Gilbert Wright, it was a relatively simple trick. Two generators of sound, sort of like headphones, would be held up against your throat while you silently mouth the words, making the instrument speak. Once any engineer would have seen the device, he would know that he would easily duplicate it. So to protect his patent and income, Wright would not sell the machines, he would only rent them, and along with the machine would come a person, an articulator, who supposedly had undergone at least 6 months training to make the instrument or train talk.
So all records and radio programs that used this effect had to have a credit line for Sonovox, or up would pop the lawyers. Let's get back to Sparky's Magic Piano.
Sparky, oh Sparky.
What? Who's that? Who's calling me?
It is I, your piano.
play piano, but you're talking.
Yes, I can talk, and I can play myself.
We got an even greater variety of talking instruments in Rusty and Orchesterville.
Here comes Vera the violin. Why don't you say hello to her and see whether she can talk or not?
Hello, Miss Violin.
Good day, Rusty.
Why, you can really talk.
Violin sings alive, child, of course I can.
That's Vera Violin's mother and father, the cello and big bass viol. Don't you try playing the cello first?
I'd be honored, Master Rusty, if you would.
Now can I play the big bass viol too?
Well, all right.
Boy, there's the trumpet now. Look how bright and shiny he is. I want to play him.
What would you like to play? What's going on out there?
Who's that?
Oh, just Tommy's older brother, Tony the trombone, and the big awkward bassoon.
I am the voice of the big bassoon.
Recognize the conductor? It was the deep-voiced munchkin, Billy Bletcher.
But let's get back to raising pitch and tempo by speeding up recordings. As mentioned, ventriloquists like Edgar Bergen, Paul Winchell, and Sherry Lewis performed live and were able to produce these funny-sounding voices naturally. But one radio performer knew he couldn't do the funny voices, and instead resorted to speed modification of his voice for the comic characters on his program, No School Today. Starting at WLW Cincinnati in 1947, Big John Arthur took his elf, Sparky, nationally on ABC and internationally on Armed Forces Radio in 1950.
Well, the whole gang is here to answer some questions, and I've got them too. First, Big John. Did you ever in your life see the devil kiss his wife?
No, I never in my life saw the devil kiss his wife.
Using the overdubbing techniques being introduced by Patty Page and Les Paul, Big John was even able to sing along with Sparky and Twinkle.
Now come on, everybody join in, the whole gang, and sing one about a cat and a mouse and a rat. Ready?
I never know who saw a keep tight cold. Eat a mishy, mousy, mousy, or a leaf that.
Notice that these voices were created with speed changes of perhaps 30%, like had been done in The Wizard of Oz. But that was to become different in 1956.
By this time, every sound engineer and many kids had been playing around with reel-to-reel tape recorders. Most had at least two speeds, and unlike turntables, these speeds were exactly half or double of each other. So it should have been expected that included in the first famous drop-in record, The Flying Saucer by Buchanan and Goodman, there would be a double-speeded spaceman.
That crafty engineer, Dickie Goodman, also included a short segment recorded backwards.
Tell us, have you come to conquer the world?
As soon as we realized what this was, every kid grabbed that record and tried to figure out a way to play it with the record spinning backwards.
Playing recordings backwards is another technique to modify the envelope of the sound. And 10 years later, during my father's generation's protest stage, this technique would reemerge as backwards masking.
Yes, it was either an insidious plot of devil worship or a way of bedeviling our elders. But that was the 60s. Let's go back to the more naive era of the 50s.
In 1958, double-speeded voices reappeared in three groundbreaking novelty records. The space theme was repeated in country star Sheb Woolley's Purple People Eater, but the double-speeded character itself was heard just briefly.
Sing a bop.
Tequila.
Also in 1958, songwriter and performer Ross Bagdasarian, recording under the name David Seville, created an exotic earthbound character with a double-speeded voice, the Witch Doctor. Again, the strange voice is heard only in contrast with regular voices, but the chorus he sang became famous. Bagdasarian recorded his part and the background music first, and had to match tempo to the recording played at half speed. Because it was half speed, the musical key did not need any transposing, because halving or doubling speed lowers or raises the pitch exactly one octave. For the Christmas season, Bagdasarian tripled the fun by creating the chipmunks.
Okay, Simon?
Okay.
Okay, Theodore?
Okay.
Okay, Alvin? Alvin? Alvin!
Okay!
Playing the recording at half speed reveals that each of the three characters had a distinctly different speaking voice. The half-speed playback also reveals something that none of the many imitators were able to duplicate, a very tight and vibrant harmony of the three voices.
Christmas, Christmas time is near. Time for toys and time for cheer.
Notice how in each of these records, the altered speed voices always appear along with a normal sounding voice and normal instruments. This is exactly the technique that was described in 1905.
But time marches on, and chipmunks and nutty squirrels, they were commonplace. By 1967, Dad's generation needed something else to shake up the folks.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha.
Jerry Samuels, using the name Napoleon XIV, only slightly speeded up his voice during the end of the choruses. But in the very rare album that followed, he used double speed to very good effect in the song Split Level Head.
I've lived in apartments, I've lived in a home. I've traveled in trailers when I used to roam. But now in these places you won't have me yet, but I'm happy I live in a split level head. Now you want your own, so no worries about here. You said you wouldn't have them, I'd play like I do. Well, your kind of level, where I'm not dead, because I'm happy I live in a split level head. If you're kind of people, I wouldn't care less. I might run for money and I might run a mess. The door opens the door, I don't make a bed, because I'm happy I live in a split level head.
A great record. Too bad it made fun of schizophrenia. Politically incorrect, way ahead of its time.
Well, all of these records were banned from most radio stations within a week. So many stations were embarrassed when they had to admit that the number one record on their sales chart that week was They're Coming to Take Me Away, a record they couldn't play. A decade earlier, playback speed also became controversial when country star Stuart Hamblin was accused of speeding up a recording of a choir to create the Cowboy Church Sunday School Choir. Is Miss Emery really 9 years old? Now listen to this example at regular speed and then hear how she suddenly reaches adulthood when played back just 10% slower.
When you see somebody cheating, don't you dare stoop to cheat. Go on by, go on by. Cheaters will be losers, what you sow you'll have to reap. Go on by, go on by. When you see somebody cheating, don't you dare stoop to cheat. Go on by. be losers. What you sow, you'll have to reap.
The effect is more striking on their big hit, Open Up Your Heart and Let the Sun Shine In, but I have not been able to find any of my three copies of the record, and somebody with too much money outbid me in Kurt's auction this last time. Fortunately, the guy didn't see the 16-inch Armed Forces radio transcription that I was able to get this example off of.
Leah?
Yes, Leah?
We've been waiting for you to tell about how it is possible to shift the pitch of a voice or music without changing the speed or tempo.
Remember, we are doing this effect live.
Well, most people...
Most people think that this effect, pitch shifting, is a product of the digital era. But actually, although pitch and tempo are normally connected in recordings and are naturally varied in unison, there was a technique used as early as the 1930s that by use of a special analog tape recorder with multiple rotating heads, it was possible to vary the pitch of a sound without changing its tempo.
I understand that this was a feature on the original German AEG portable magnetophone model K1. I don't have one of those. My machine is the first high-quality AEG magnetophone studio model, K2. But this rotating head system reappeared in the 1960s in a German machine that Steve Timmer's Gotham Audio imported, the Eltro. I saw Steve give a demonstration of it in 1967. It was mainly designed for compressed speech. For readings for the blind, you could play back intelligible speech 50 to 100% faster. For broadcasting, it would allow a commercial or a newscast to be replayed faster, and the resulting higher pitch of the voice would be reduced to normal by the Eltro. This is a sample from the Eltro of a demo record showing a newscast, or this is just the beginning of it, had been reduced from 4.5 minutes in length to 3.5.
W-O-R.
It's 20 minutes before the hour of 12 noon, time for WOR-FM News. A sharp verbal clash is reported to have occurred between President Johnson and Senator Robert Kennedy when the senator recently returned from Europe. Time magazine says that Johnson denounced Kennedy for his stand on Vietnam and warned his political career would end rapidly if he persisted in his views. Kennedy is said to have called the president an unpleasant name, but this is denied by the senator's aides.
They also demonstrated that the machine could be used to allow records to be speeded up and restored in pitch to allow a station to fit in more records in the same time. This is a sample played at the full speed, plus 5% in speed, and plus 10% in speed. It did it by moving the rotating head wheel in the machine in the direction of the motion of the tape. I'll give you a demonstration of this in a moment. That would reduce the relative tape to head speed and reduce the pitch without reducing the tempo because the tape was moving at a fixed speed. It would reduce the pitch of a live voice, or it would reduce the pitch of a previously made recording that would be played back at a higher speed. This is a diagram of a machine that we'll show you in a second that was made at about the same time, late 50s, early 60s, called the Whirling Dervish. The tape is moving in this direction. It is first, the old recording is first erased, and then there is a new recording from an external machine that would be recorded. It goes past this head wheel, which could move either in the direction of the tape moving or in the opposing direction. In other words, reducing the relative or increasing the relative tape to head motion. This is the capstan and the pinch roller. Now, if we can move this away, we can show you the videotape of the Whirling Dervish itself.
This is the head wheel. And the tape is going across the heads. We'll stop in a second and you'll see the... This is one lamination here. Here's another. Here's another. As one leaves the tape, the next picks up.
These are the contacts in the back of the machine that takes the audio off of the four heads. It's belt driven from an external motor. And you see now we're moving the head wheel in the opposing direction. And that is increasing the relative tape to speed, tape to head speed when the tape will start moving. Slowing it down, now the head wheel is moving in the opposite direction. So here's the erase head, the record head, the play head, this very large capstan and pinch roller. The tape is going to be moving about maybe 20 or 30 feet per second. This is a bin loop. And we're starting to move the head. And the tape is whizzing by. You'll see in a second how fast the tape is moving when we angle it so that you can see the surface of the tape. But there is the bin loop, continuous tape loop. And that's the motor that is moving the head. These are the motor controls that were done externally. This was a machine that the University of Louisville used for experimentation in compressed speech. So they had this calibrated with a crown machine. Watch the splice go by. You just went whizzing by. There it is again. That's how fast the tape is moving. Now, as the head wheel turns, it either cuts out little minute instances of instantaneous instances of sound, or you hear little little tiny slivers twice. But the tape is moving so fast, and the head wheel is moving so fast, you don't notice those little losses of sound or increases of sound. I just move the head wheel now to go in the opposing direction, putting the pinch roller up to the capstan, and now the tape is going to start moving again. This is a rather scary machine to be to be working with. I didn't have a chance to get the audio working, but when this machine did work, it worked pretty much like the Eltro, although I believe the Eltro used reels of tape that were on the machine. And so you would have to pre-record anything that you would put into the Eltro. I'm not sure if it was able to be done live. This might also have been used, we're not sure, but it may have been used to disguise voices on the TV program Masquerade Party in the 1950s. We haven't been able to get to the kinescopes of that series in the Sam Levinson collection, otherwise we would have had an example of that for you. Okay, you can go to the VSC.
I can just start it?
Or the Eventide. Which goes first? VSC, I think. Yeah.
Back in the early 1970s, a company called 13. VSC invented a circuit called the variable speed. Back in the early 1970s, a company called VSC invented a circuit called the variable speech control. This is an analog bucket brigade type of circuit and was built into some cassette recorders. Realistic Radio Shack and General Electric were the main ones. And I'm playing this cassette on one of these machines. Now it has two controls on it in addition to normal controls. One of them is a variable speed control, which can go from slightly slower than normal, 0.8, up to about two times normal speed. Right alongside of it is another sliding control, which is a pitch shifter, which now reduces the pitch to as much as half. So now if you have these two controls together and you slide them up, you can increase the speed of a recording
reducing its pitch by the same amount, and be able to continue to understand the speech up to twice normal speed. Now, you can also use these controls separately. For example, I can take the pitch shifter control.
And without changing the speed of the tape, I can reduce the pitch. What I can also do is
have the pitch at normal and increase the speed. That's just a normal speed control.
But I can also now vary both of them, not keeping them identical, and so I could increase the speed of a tape and not reduce the pitch by the same amount, or I could reduce the pitch by even greater amounts. So
there are a lot of little tricks you can play with this thing, as well as use it in its normal fashion,
that would enable you to listen to a spoken word cassette
at twice normal speed and still be able to understand it.
The one thing they did not do was build in to the VSC control a way to raise pitch. What they assumed was, of course, that since you could increase the speed,
you could make a recording by speaking slower and increase the speed of the cassette and come up with the same result.
In the late 1970s, the Eventide company introduced the Harmonizer, which was the first digital pitch shifter, which could raise or lower the pitch of sound independently of tempo. It was a high-quality studio device, which, unlike the earlier analog devices, did its work almost undetectably. Used in conjunction with the high-quality variable-speed video available on 1-inch Type-C videotape, TV stations found they could slightly speed up programs undetectably and add a commercial or two without having to edit the program. One of the more innovative uses of digital pitch shifting is the 1980 electronic composition by Charles Dodge, Any Resemblance is Purely Coincidental. Dodge used as his sound source a demo recording from Soundstream, where one of Thomas Stockham's students, Neil J. Miller, had digitally removed the orchestra from Enrico Caruso's most famous recording, the 1907 version of Vesta la Giubba, from Leon Cavallo's I Pagliacci. Dodge took this demo, which had synchronized on two separate tracks, the original version with the orchestra, with the version without the orchestra, and turned to the latter all around with extremes in the changes of pitch. For example, Dodge took the first word of the prologue to the aria, recita, which had been sung with all three syllables on one pitch, and repeated it over and over with different melodies, but all at the same original tempo. Dodge also took Caruso's famous laugh, which had been sung in a descending scale, and changed it to an ascending scale. It is believed that this was accomplished with the newly introduced digital Eventide harmonizer, although this work could have been produced with an analog pitch shifter, such as the Whirling Dervish. If it had used the common analog technique of speed change to produce pitch change, the tempo of the recording would have been changed in accord with the amount of pitch change.
Caruso was again subjected to pitch shifting, as some of you will remember, in an Ars presentation by David Hamilton, where he presented the Caruso brothers, changing the tenor into a baritone and a bass, and even a soprano as their tag-along sister. David still insists that the recordings are real and were not created with an Eventide harmonizer.
As an interesting side note, when digital pitch shifting became available, Ross Bagdasarian Jr., who had taken over the Chipmunk Empire from his late father, attempted to use it and found it thoroughly unsatisfactory. The only way he could retain the familiar sound of the sped-up voices was to continue to use the analog double-speed technique. Digital pitch shifting didn't sound right. Let's not underestimate what magical effects can be accomplished with simple analog recording devices. In 1948, CBS installed their first tape recorders in their New York studios, and tape's versatility immediately attracted the attention of Jim Fassett, who produced the intermission features for the New York Philharmonic Symphony broadcasts. He started exploring the ways sound could be modified to create interesting and sometimes unidentifiable variations. These intermission features that Jim Fassett produced for the New York Philharmonic Symphony broadcasts created such wide interest that they were released on record.
What you've just heard is the new Columbia long playing record, which is called Strange to Your Ears. A recording unlike anything that's ever been issued before. A fascinating venture into the weird, newly explored world of sound. Who can identify this sound? Identify that. We're not going to taunt you by withholding the answer till the end of this record, but when you hear what it is, you won't believe it. At least you won't understand it. That sound came from three little notes extracted from this.
That particular effect is one of the more complicated ones he created, one which required extensive editing, looping, speed change, and overdubbing.
We'll leave till the end of this experimental record the explanation of how that weird sound at the beginning was compiled.
Many of Jim Fassett's simpler effects could have been produced just as easily on disc recorders and variable speed turntables. In those years, the few disc recorders they had were not easily accessible to producers to do foolish experiments. They actually were not all that versatile. Broadcast studio turntables before 1949 operated at two fixed speeds of 78.26 and 33 1/3 RPM. Only the sound effects turntables had continuously variable speed capabilities, and some of the sound manipulations we just heard were probably performed on a CBS radio sound effects truck. Fassett explained to listeners how they could do some simple sound modifications themselves on their new dual-speed LP turntables.
The most fundamental device you've probably done yourself, inadvertently, on your own record player at home. You know, when you forget to change the speed control from 78 to 33, or vice versa, you'll be playing some 78s and then put on maybe a vocal record that's recorded at 33, but you forgot to change the speed, and the baritone turns into Donald Duck. And everybody laughs and, oh, forgot to change the speed. It's one of the devices we use, simple as that. Just changing the speed of the tape machine, up or down, faster or slower. You know how it sounds the other way when you play a 78 at 33. This woman's voice, for instance. But you forgot to change the speed, and... whoops, she's a baritone.
The tape recorders CBS had installed were also dual speed, but the speeds were at ratios of double or half, which, as we discussed earlier, could enable recordings to be raised or lowered in exact octaves. Using multiple dubs, or having machines with different speed configurations from 7.5 to 30 inches per second, could allow for the easy alteration of 2, 3, or 4 octaves. Many advanced musical effects like this one could not have easily been done on turntables.
Here's that same tune played on one of the purest and highest instruments, the flute. Now the obbligato to that tune played on one of the lowest instruments, and one that's very rich in those overtones we demonstrated on the piano. Here's the tuba. Now for the experiment. We're going to lower the pitch of the flute by 3 octaves, playing the same tune, but the quality will be changed, because the overtones, the few it has, will be 3 octaves lower too. Do just the opposite with the tuba. We'll play it 3 times higher than the original. let's play the duet upside down with the tuba obbligato at the top and the flute playing the melody at the bottom. It's still the flute and the tuba, but not as you're accustomed to hearing them. The quality is altered as well as the pitch.
In addition to fooling around with the pitches of sounds, Jim Fassett also played with the easy ability to play tape recordings backwards.
You'll have the pianist play this tune from the end to the beginning. You'll play it backwards, starting with the last chord. We'll reverse the tape of this tune, as the pianist has just played it, backwards, so you'll hear it forward again. Understand what we're doing now. The pianist has just played the tune backwards, from the end back to the beginning. But we'll play what is recorded in reverse, so you'll hear it from the beginning to the end again, but with a strange difference. Listen. You say it sounds like an organ? Of course, you see why, because each time the piano notes are struck, the sound starts immediately to die out. It fades, decays. But you're so used to hearing this fading out of each tone or chord that you don't even notice it. But when you reverse the tape and play it backwards, the dying sound is what you hear first, growing louder instead of softer, and ending instead of beginning with the chord being struck.
Playing recordings backwards was a new way to modify the envelope of a musical sound. We earlier heard how Sonovox modified the envelope of musical sounds to get the Broma Seltzer train and Sparky's magic piano to talk. But Jim Fassett had another trick up his sleeve.
I'll say my name as clearly as I can. Jim Fassett. Jim Fassett. Here it is, played backwards. It's half amazing. Now I'll say it backwards, just as carefully as I can, copying what you just heard. Tesaf-mij. Now we'll reverse the tape and play that forward again.
Jim Fassett.
Rock and roll had not yet emerged from its roots in rhythm and blues, but Jim Fassett was already explaining how, several decades in the future, rock performers could inject backwards masked messages into their records. But a few minutes ago, we heard Jim Fassett promise to tell us how he made a weird sound out of the song of a canary. So listen now as he explains how he and his engineer Mortimer Goldberg did this complex reconstruction using as their only tools a pair of early analog tape recorders, a razor blade, and some splicing tape.
Now, I want to explain how we compiled that sound you heard at the very start. We looked for three different sustained notes in this song of the canary, and we found them this way. You notice those three notes sung together? We isolated them, these. Then we looked for another sustained note, and we found one, a third below. In the middle of that little sequence, and we extracted them. Then a third note appeared later on in the song. The one with the catch before it, this. We eliminated the catch, the prefix. Here were our three notes, a third apart from each other. Then we blended them together, the three notes in a triad. We lowered this triad one octave. Then we lowered it a second octave and blended the two together. third octave below and add it to the other two. A sound made from three little notes from the song of a canary. Another demonstration of how the most familiar sounds can become strange to your ears.
That was produced over 50 years ago on simple analog tape recorders by Jim Fassett of CBS, a nearly forgotten, but now legendary, pioneer in sound manipulation.
Recording all these sounds in the studio, it had to be so quiet you could hear a pin drop. It was, so we dropped a pin. Want to hear a pin drop, the way it sounds when we get through with it?
During the next few years, there were several innovative musical recordings, such as Delirium and Hi-Fi, what you hear right now, by Andre Pop, disguised as Elsa Popping and her Pixieland band. In the examples playing behind me, Pop utilized speed-altered instruments and tempo shifting as some of the instruments, merely using analog tape manipulations. Peter Sellers turned himself into a high-pitched scatting trombone on a track, Lady Be Good, that we don't have time to play. There has been a resurgence in using double... There has been a resurgence in using double-speeded trick effects in rap recordings.
But that's not my kind of music, so I wouldn't know about such things.
Hey, don't assume it's my kind of music either. That's why I actually don't have any of the recordings to actually play. But I can tell you that, you know, among the many artists that I've heard use it, the hip-hop artist Akon centers his song, Lonely, around a sped-up sample of Bobby Vinton's Mr. Lonely. And believe me, you haven't heard Bobby Vinton until he makes him sound like a young Wayne Newton.
So there's our lesson examples in manipulating sound. And there are other examples, but these are really the ones that are the most historic. And we thank you for your attention.